on weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, big thanks to Bennett and Silva for blasting out the tunes this afternoon. It's Monday, the 22nd of July, and what maybe felt like the first day of summer, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up today, well, it was a final for the ages, and we'll reflect on Clare's return to hurling's highest point.
It's going to land in around the Hill 16 goal. They're batting for Cork. The opportunity here, hit in by Robbie O'Flynn, and it's wise. It's wise in the last puck of the game. And it's all over. And Clare are the All-Ireland Hurling Champions 2024. It's only their fifth All-Ireland since the championship began 137 years ago.
Well, we'll have more on that with Niall Moran shortly. Ian O'Riordan is in studio to look ahead to the Olympics before he heads for Paris. While in golf, Amy Burns looks back on Schauffler's success at the Open. All of that, plus Alan Cawley on FAI Cup upsets and the rest of our weekend sporting highlights. If you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or contact us on WhatsApp 087 187 9200.
Game on 2FM.
Well, a very good evening. Ian O'Riordan and Alan Cawley are in studio this evening. Guys, I hope you're both well. Roundabout now, Shane Dawson would usually have some news headlines. Everywhere I've looked, I can't really find any, so I'm happy to go with the no news is good news line. Lads, had you a good weekend, Alan? Where were you?
Weekend, Ruby, yeah. I've actually had a great week. I was away for a few days, so I was home then, obviously, for the weekend and for the hurling, and I was fortunate enough to be one of those lucky spectators in Croke Park yesterday, Ruby, and I've been to a fair few sporting events in my time, and I'm a big follower of sport, as you know, and an absolute anorak when it comes to all sorts of sports, but the hurling really takes your breath away, and what I witnessed yesterday was absolutely phenomenal.
Right, the text line is buzzing here. Alan Cawley is from Sligo. What on earth was he doing at a Clare and Cork game when people couldn't get tickets?
Well, I'm a big fan, Ruby, and I was in at the semi-final, and I've been to plenty of matches, so I'll fight for my spot at that match yesterday. But it was just incredible. It really was, and the colour that both sets of supporters brought to it, for the first time in a long, long time, I actually got goosebumps just for the national anthem, and that kind of set the tone really for what was about to transpire in front of me. I was always hoping it would be a great game. I think, to be fair to the hurling, over the last 3 or 4 years, and I've obviously watched it closely and have been shouting about it really, that it's almost carried the GAA over the last 3 or 4 years, that it always delivers. But you know yourself, when it comes to finals day, sometimes it can go the other way. But what they served up, both sets of players, it was absolutely nothing short of extraordinary. It really was, from start to finish, drawn at half time, drawn at full time, drawn still in half time and extra time, and then to be separated by just a point at the end. But I think what really kind of stuck out for me, Ruby, was the skill level of what I seen yesterday. And you always hope that the best players will turn up on the biggest of days, and what Tony Kelly produced yesterday in front of my eyes was absolutely unbelievable. It really was. The goal itself was just, I just got up out of my seat. I couldn't believe what I'd actually seen. It was unbelievable, the goal. But then there was a couple of points afterwards as well, where he swiveled almost in a loop. It looked impossible what he was trying to do, but yet he put it over the bar. And then in the moments when it was really close and tight, when they needed someone to stand up, there was a point that he got, and I think it was an extra time, where he actually won the ball back himself, and then he flicked it over a fella's head, and then he put it over as well. So he was just doing phenomenal things in the midst of the madness that was going on. And that's not to take away from any other player, who all played unbelievable. All the other lads contributed, but Tony Kelly was just head and shoulders. And as I said, just to see the greats perform on the greatest of days is something special.
I'm sure they were magic to watch live. When they were slowed down on television and you watched the actual scale of it in slow motion, I thought it was incredible. Ian, would you concur? Did you watch the All-Ireland? I'm assuming you did. Would you concur with Alan's view on it?
I did, thanks, Ruby. Yeah, and without being selfish about it in any way, I think there's a lot of relieved sports editors and sports journalists that it didn't go to a replay, because that would have pushed it smack bang into the middle of the Paris Olympics. And obviously that was one of the talking points afterwards, whether A, should have gone to extra time, and then B, was there going to be a replay or not, which we almost came within a point of us, or should have gone straight to a replay after normal time. I think there's pros and cons to that. I mean, certainly from a player's point of view, I'd say the vast majority would like to get the game decided on the day, as they call it. But I think, as we say, we're still talking about amateur players, and I agree with Alan there, like the skill levels and the physicality as well. I'm looking at these players, and like, they could be, any of these one could be Olympic athletes. There's so much athleticism involved in the game now, and personally I do think that after 74, 75 minutes, if they're still level, I think maybe a replay would have been the right decision, as it was for the 140 years of the G, or sorry, 120 years or whatever we're at now at the stage beforehand, until they changed that rule. But having said that, Claire, I mean, you can't deny them. Despite the slight refereeing decision at the end, I think they were possibly the deserving team on the day. But I do think it's very hard for amateur players to go back into extra time when they've psyched themselves up so much for that final, and then to lose like that, you'd certainly be feeling for Cork.
You most certainly would. Al, I'm assuming it was your highlight, or did you see anything else on the weekend? Did you kind of talk, wow?
I've seen Taylor Swift on Friday night in Gelsenkirchen, and does that count?
I thought I was bad going to Anfield. Did you go?
I was in Gelsenkirchen, yeah, with my daughter. Obviously had to bring her over, so I didn't have to bring her over, but I brought her over, and it was just that was every bit as good as the hurling, I have to say, Ruby. I have to be honest, it was phenomenal. But no, just on Ian's point as well, I think it's relevant, Ruby, just with the whole chat about, I'm not sure if there's the whole chat, but I did see a few people mention the point that should it have went to a replay. And I always thought the hurling finals or the football finals goes automatically to a replay. So I was actually surprised when I was in the ground that it was going to extra time. And they were going down like flies, to be fair. They were out on their feet. But my take on that as well is that, and you heard it in the speech with Tony Kelly, you hear it in every speech, every manager talks about not just the 15 on the pitch, but the players that turn up training every week, part of the squad, and even the lads that are not togged out. So my take on that is that if you do get down to extra time, that's an opportunity for lads who may not obviously they didn't get the start, but they might not have even came on in the match, but then they'll come on in extra time and contribute as well, because they all talk about how they need everyone in it together in terms of the squad and what everyone brings to a training session, driving the first 15 on, if you like. So I actually think that was maybe lads who might not get the plaudits are probably getting a lot of praise today back home and Clare for coming on and contributing in extra time as well.
I'd say you also have to look at it from their own personal lives as well. So there are amateurs, they all have other jobs, etc., and time off work, what they would have planned for next week, how many days they would have taken off last week. It's just, I'd say, it's just not as easy as go home, lads, and come into work and turn up again. So I personally would have thought extra time was the correct call, and we did get a winner, but we'll delve into that with Niall Moore maybe a little later on and see what he thinks about it. But Ian, had you a sporting highlight this weekend?
Well, the other thing I point out is I'm still, despite what some people, cynics might say, I'm still a big fan of the Tour de France. So for the last 3 weeks, that's always been on in the background. Every afternoon, I flick it on about lunchtime, and it's just beautiful sort of background scenic television every afternoon. But this year, as probably people know, we have Tadej Pogačar from Slovenia won back to Tour de France after losing the last two to the Jonas Vingegaard, and it was a kind of the classic duel, the classic showdown between the two riders. Now, inevitably in the Tour de France, there's the backdrop of doping and whether you can actually believe what you're seeing. And obviously Pogačar winning by, I think he won by over 6 minutes. He won six stages, including the last stage. He broke every climbing record from Lance Armstrong to Marco Pantani all the way down through the years. So he's just going where no cyclist has gone before, and you're kind of going, can you believe in this? And there's no doubt towards the end of last week, when he just kept winning stages and he was opening more time on Vingegaard, it's that nagging question in the back of your mind, can you actually believe this? And cycling, unfortunately, is still caught in that realm where just the history alone, you just cannot invest too much of your belief in that. You're almost watching it with suspended belief. But in terms of sporting performances, what he did in the Tour de France over the last three weeks, first man to win the Giro and the Tour, I think, since Marco Pantani in over 30 years. So one of the cycling greats, still only 26. I just hope we're not having this conversation 3 or 4 years down the road and like, how were we all sucked into this guy? How did we all sort of fall for him? He's extremely popular amongst his teammates. He's extremely popular in the peloton. He seems to have this huge fan base, Poggy as they call him. But it's when cycling, unfortunately, is one of those sports where when you have standout winners like this, you just have to suspend that belief. But fingers crossed, he's doing it clean.
Well, the Olympics are coming soon, and no doubt we'll have a few question marks there as well. We'll talk about that in a little while. Ian, what about the golf, Alan? Did you watch shit? You're obviously in Croke Park. Did you watch highlights last night or anything?
I actually watched the highlights today, Ruby, and I watched it all on Saturday, and of course with Irish eyes on as well, looking at Shane, and it was disappointing to see him unravel, really, Ruby. I was surprised because up until the eighth hole, that par 3, the postage stamp. He was he looked so in control. And then obviously it's a difficult hole. He went into the bunker and it was a tricky bunker shot. And then he made a double bogey. And I thought, fair enough, you regroup, you make a mistake. It's no shock to anyone that you make a bogey in the odd hole in Royal Troon, especially when the conditions were as difficult as they were. But he kind of unravelled then, which surprised me to see him drop off so much. But Schauffele, even watching him on Saturday, he looked so steady and so in control. And it's amazing the confidence, I suppose, one major can give you, because as I said, he looked so composed and in control throughout even Saturday when he was in the chasing pack, and then obviously he delivered yesterday. And once he got to the point, even looking back on it today, and even though I knew the winner, just looking to the point where you're seeing his name amongst the likes of Justin Rose, Russell Henley, the South African lad, it was almost sticking out that he would go on and obviously move through the gears and go on and win it. And he's a fantastic player, Xander Schauffele. I'm a big fan. But there's something, I don't know about the golf, I'm not sure about you, Ruby, but there's something human almost about seeing them struggle. It's kind of nice to see them struggle in the difficult conditions as well, and it almost makes it look a bit real, because they're so good. And when you see them making birdie after birdie on the PGA Tour week after week, it almost looks a bit false at times. So to see them struggle in those like unbelievably difficult conditions, I actually enjoy watching that as well.
So do I. Seeing him hitting out of bunkers and missing greens, thinking, yeah, at least it's not just me. They can do that too. It kind of makes you feel better about yourself. That's how I felt about it. Did you watch the golf, Ian, though?
I did, yeah. I've got a passing interest in the golf as well. And almost again, because we've gone back to the Paris Olympics, we have two real medal contenders in Lowry and obviously McIlroy. I mean, whatever about McIlroy's form at the weekend, I think he can raise his game for the Olympics. I mean, there's something about the gravitas of playing in what is up at the Palace of Versailles, and I'd be very surprised if McIlroy doesn't turn it around, and knowing that Larry's in form again. So I think if we're going to win a medal in golf in the Olympics, I'd like to think it could be done in Paris, the old bastion of French royalty up in the Palace of Versailles.
Well, despite we spoke about this, didn't we, a few weeks back, Ruby, when they played together and won, and yeah. We said the fact that he, no matter what's going on with Rory, he almost plays better. Shane brings out the best in him, like, you know, they're a good company together. So I think they have a serious chance.
Yeah,
Shane might need Rory this week, lads. That could be, it could be the other way around. Yeah. One could be leaning on the other. Don't forget Stephanie Meadows and Leona Maguire as well. But look, we have a jam-packed show this afternoon, so we're going to, or evening even. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with Niall Moran and the hurling.
Game on 2FM.
Well, yeah, I gave it everything. I think everyone out there gave it everything, including the Cork lads. It was just one of those days. Went to 80 or 90 minutes, and you know, just so glad to come out the right side of it, but it could have been either way.
Game on.
Hurling.
Welcome back to Game On. So we are going to turn our attention to yesterday's All-Ireland final, and I'm not going to try and put words on it, because I think Tony Kelly had a magnificent quote last night when he said it was a fantastic game to play in. Niall Moran joins us on the line. It was certainly a fantastic game to watch, Niall.
Breathtaking, Ruby. One of the most magical days that was ever had in Croke Park, and I say that as a partisan neutral, if there's such a thing. I suppose from early hours above Croke Park, above Dublin, the colour, just the sheer brightness of the red, and obviously the yellow mixed in with it. The sun was shining on it. The banter between both sets of supporters, it was just so, so positive. And like, you'd be walking down Jones's Road, and I suppose it's a pilgrimage that people have made for years and years, and 140, 150 years of the GAA's storied history. But each and every time is unique, and you walk down, you see the colours, and see the people coming together, and see all the people who you've seen throughout all the years. You see people who've been to 60 and 70 All-Irelands on the trot, and despite the ticket frenzy that took place during the week, they still managed to get one last minute. And it was just really one of the most magical days I can remember in Croke Park, and it was capped off by just an incredible game. I don't know where you'd start in describing it, but I suppose it's just the respect, the enduring respect that you'd have for these guys. These lads, these players, the referees, the people who've given their time to throw up a spectacle like that. And I know it's often quoted and things like that, but really, there is nothing else like it in the world rugby. And I felt like one of those privileged few to see it.
The skill, the pace, the ferocity, the ebbs and flows of the game. Like, if you could bottle the entertainment, you'd be a millionaire. It was incredible stuff from start to finish.
It was, and that was just lads in between the halves, kind of going to the bathroom and stuff. The pace of it, but no, as in it was. I don't know where you'd start. Like, it was, do you start with the sublime goals that we saw? Probably two of the greatest goals ever scored in All Ireland, one by a defender, one by the Mercurials. Tony Kelly. I even know that as you walk through the Cusack stands, there's obviously kind of a statue, walk on statues, but obviously kind of sort of tributes to the great teams, the teams of the millennium, and you see all the famous names that adorn it, the Rings, the Mackeys, the Jim Langtons, and I think we saw one of them adorning it on the pitch there yesterday in Tony Kelly, in the nature of the goals that he scored, the goal that he scored. I suppose even the timing of his scores for a player that they often said went missing when the pressure came on, this guy delivered when Clare's need was highest. Like you look at, you know what I mean? You could start anywhere, the pace of the two Clare cornerbacks, you know what I mean? The defiance of the Clare halfbacks like John Conlon, Dave McInerney, all the way through to Cal Malone up front. And then you look at, it was at its equal on the Cork side. I was sitting beside a couple of gentlemen that were affiliated to Glen Rovers, and the pride that they showed in their own, the two Downey brothers and Patrick Horgan. And you know, in those, probably we had the, maybe I won't call it the future and the past of Cork hurling, because Pat Horgan has still a lot more to offer. But I suppose it was just an incredible, it's very, very hard to find the words to describe it. And I think for any of your listeners there, Ruby, I made the trip back to Limerick very, very late last night, and I dropped my wife to the Clare banquet. I was going in camouflage in case I was seen passing it, but I dropped her off to us, and on the road down from Limerick, I just happened to listen to Páraig Lodge's commentary for the All-Ireland. It kept me going, and for any of your listeners there who have a few minutes, if they just even listen to his broadcast on the parade going on, it was just, it put the hair standing on the back of your neck. There's no words to describe sort of a day that was had yesterday, and I think if you could amply try to quantify it, I think Páraig Lodge definitely did it day yesterday.
I thought the very same, so I did when I heard the end of it in the car yesterday as well. But when you look at Tony Kelly's goal and the magic of his skill with his hurl, and then you look at Robbie Downey with the slitter on the hurl, and the Clare, I'm not sure which Clare defender or forward was chasing him, but to be able to outrun the Clare forward, the length of the pitch, we're basically running with one arm. That's incredible.
We're running one arm. Like, we're going to look at the Olympics in 2 weeks' time. We're going to marvel at the 400-metre runners. So Rob Downey was like a Thomas Barr herring off down the pitch.
It was incredible, wasn't it?
Like the Red Sea before Moses, it kind of opened up. And a little bit like what Tony Kelly said, it's not that you set off to score these goals, but when you keep on going and you're in the moment, and so what we often forget is the wall of noise as you make it closer to those goals, like it's actually freakish. Like as in the loud, when the chance becomes apparent, the crowd react to it, and you as a player, you can sense it, you can hear it, but you still go then and you execute a finish like that after a run like that in an amphitheatre like Croke Park. Like some of the nature of the scores, like Seamus Harnedy, a guy there who's given 12, 14 years, 4 points in play. Dermot Ryan, halfback, his brother was man of the match 3 years ago, 3 outstanding points in play. Like, you know, things that we just take for granted, the skills of the Mark Rogers. I just think we're so blessed, and I think in fairness to Jarlett Burns, I think he really articulated the feeling that was in Croke Park and within the country yesterday, where he spoke about these heroes that adorned our pitches, and that they come from rural clubs, and that they're people that you go to work with, that you go to mass with, that coach your kids, do you know what I mean, that help out in the community. And I suppose for the diaspora, those people who were in the Sydneys and New Yorks and all these various places, like, you know, yesterday was a homecoming for them, where they kind of came together in the pubs and clubs around the world. And I suppose you showed that sense of being Irish. And I know the great late Micheál Muirchertaig often said that it should be a bank holiday Monday after an All-Ireland final, and who am I to disagree with him? I think it's the one time where we just felt our Irishness, everything that was important to us, you just got that sense of it right the way throughout. And look, the biggest pity, Ruby, is that it's over for another year, and so as well, while the darkness comes in or whatever, it won't be long before the flowers start to bud again. And I for one, anyway, I'm counting down the minutes till next year in 2025.
Well, what an advertisement it is for Ireland, wherever it was beamed in the world yesterday. But on a whole, you were in neutral, you were in Croke Park. Did the right team win?
In real time, I thought they were the better team. I thought that they really, look, Cork got off to a hair of a start. Obviously, look, the first 8 shots after 11 minutes, they're 1-7. That's incredible. People said they couldn't repeat that kind of shooting. They did, but then, you know what I mean, I suppose, Clare won 8-4 down, and then Shane Lannan just decided, he rolled up the sleeves and he said, this is going to be our day, we're not going to be defeated again. You know what I mean? I suppose he created a goal out of nothing twice over. He created a goal out of nothing, got the next 2 points, and all of a sudden, Clare were in the game, they were back in the game. And
whilst Tony Kelly most definitely was the person you could attribute to winning the game for Clare, there's no doubt in my mind that Shane Lannan was the guy that pulled them back into it when they really, really needed it. And look, at halftime, 112-112 for Cork people, it was a laugh in itself because they were in a great, great position. All they needed to do was kick on a little bit more, keep that gap for a while. So, look, Cork people will testify, look, there's probably chances that they might have felt that they should have got. Maybe there was a slight chance of a penalty with a few minutes to go for drawing the foul by David Mack. Obviously, at the end, they'll have sort of regrets that Johnny Murphy maybe didn't blow for a point. But it's actually interesting, Ruby, in real time, irrespective of the minor tug, and I am going to say it was a minor tug because these things are exasperated by when they're so down and they're on social media and stuff. It was a minor tug, a momentary tug. Like, so it's Robbie Finn, he still managed to get the shot away. And to be fair to the Cork team and the backroom team, I didn't see him complain to Johnny Murphy afterwards. And just on this, Ruby, and I know I've come to this man's acclaim on a number of times, I thought Johnny Murphy was exceptional yesterday. And that's not as a Limerick man, I'm saying that. That's as a neutral. Like, there was multiple times when you could have blown for teams. Yeah, you could have, but he let advantage go. And oftentimes they're talking to Kilkenny, especially about the spirit of the game. And I think he refereed it in the spirit of the game. And I think if you sat down with both sets of players today, despite their elation and disappointment, on the other hand, I think they'd both attest to that. And we're very, very lucky that we have referees at all, because on the ground, they're very, very hard guys. And so, I'm thrilled for Johnny as well, like that. At this stage, he's around a long time. He's had to endure a lot too. And I just thought he'd probably give one of his greatest displays of refereeing there yesterday. And so you have to acknowledge that, because nobody's on the referee's side as we go up to Croke Park. But without him, we wouldn't have had the classic that we had.
Well, I'm definitely not going to disagree with you, but what about Cork? Will this be hard to get over, or can they build on it?
Of course they can build on it. I suppose, like, they're a lot further up the road. They're certainly what they were last year, but that doesn't mean that you're going to get back to an All-Ireland final. And so one of the things that you learn, and well, unfortunately we only ever got to play in one All-Ireland, and one thing you learn is that there's no marks awarded for the merit and the defeat. Like, do you know what I mean? All that you have is that sense of loss. And like, next year rolls around and everyone's at the same start line. You don't know what happens. You don't know, does injury curtail it? Do lads take time out of the game? Do lads retire from the game? And I think for Cork people tonight is about just reflecting on, you know, what was a marvellous year. They've kind of really come back to the table. I think they've garnered an awful lot of the respect that they felt might have kind of drifted from them over recent years. But again, it's a stepping stone to it, and as soon as you step forward, you can often take two steps back. So if you're talking about the long-term future, and it's that today isn't the day to really be talking about it, and all they would have is a sense of loss. But if they are to take anything from the victors yesterday in Clare, I just think the one word that categorises them is defiance. And I know it's been used. I suppose we all saw them lose their Munster finals, and they had to endure the celebrations both in Limerick and in Thurles, and that's not very, very easy to do it. And they kept on coming back. And in Brian Lohan, they had a manager who, who defied a lot of people. He went in there 5 years ago. He's turned the county upside down, inside out, both structurally, both on the playing field, both spiritually. He's bought his supporters back. And again, he's had to endure a lot of people's criticism and, you know, getting a call wrong here or there. And I just think, look, that defiance, and I know I might be going off topic here, but I suppose that defiance is what categorises our GAA players, our sports players. You defy things. So it makes more sense a lot of the time not to be part of an inter-county panel, especially in the lesser counties, whereby you're sacrificing your professional, your personal, your social life for this thing. But there's always that sense of there's something bigger. And I think, again, maybe going back to what Jarna spoke about yesterday, that something sense of bigger was just the GAA, and that sense of pride and who you are and where you come from means to you. And so for that Clare people, I just think it bled out of them as the game went on there yesterday. And they defied every, even going down to 7 points, they defied it. Do you know what I mean? Even when they went a couple of points down, and afterwards they kept them coming. So look, as I said, hurling is a religion, and Lohan is his god, like, you know. It's great celebrations.
Oh, they will. And the defiance, does that categorise, it probably categorises the whole hurling season. When you think it started on the 21st of April, Limerick beat Clare and Ennis in 13 weeks. Those players, management, backroom staff, fans, families, the Cork and Clare guys have had 8 games in those 13 weeks. For amateur sports people, the commitment I think defiance is a brilliant word. Did you enjoy the campaign from start to finish?
Oh, look, for anyone who loves fine wine, you love getting a glass of it every week, and we love hurling here, and we got to drink it. To be honest, we got so much of it that we weren't able to keep it finished, and that, did I enjoy it? I just thought it was just incredible from start to finish. The one regret is the amount of games have slipped under the radar, and I suppose, look, as the winter comes in, there'll be arguments about the televising of games, and I suppose the tightness of the schedule, but I just think our standard keeps on getting better and better and better. And like to the famous Cork son, they said, Christy, you're the best that there ever was, whatever about Christy Ring, and he said the best is yet to come, and there are prophetic words because it's just getting better year on year. And I know as soon as we're having this conversation, there's men in Limerick and there's men in Waterford and Tip and Antrim and Kilkenny, they're all plotting to get going and find a couple of guys over the club championships. And so I suppose that excitement is already starting again. And look, as I said to you, it's just it was just a magnificent day, and it's amazing, Ruby. Okay, and again, it's for a lot of people even going up to Croke Park yesterday, the sense of it's a poignant occasion. For Clare people, they're reflective on 13, and a lot of those families, some of those people are no longer, and similar for Cork people. And you see their fathers, sons, and grandsons, and they're sitting beside each other, three abreast yesterday. And you know, the next time it comes around, you don't know, will one of them not be there? And you know, I suppose it's just at the end of it, as just so proud you are of it, you'd be kind of philosophical and looking forward again for it to come around. And as you said, the first round of the league this year was 3rd of February, so it won't be long coming back around.
The league won't be long coming back around, but what does Leinster Hurling have to do to some way catch up with what's going on in Munster?
No, I suppose, look, Leinster Hurling, I suppose, I would have felt that it was a very positive year in the greater, wider picture for Leinster Hurling. I suppose if you look at Carlow, got one of the biggest results in its history. Wexford made huge inroads this year with a small little bit of luck. They might have found themselves in a semi-final, even a little bit more consistency. We obviously had Antrim, highly competitive. I suppose then maybe when you look, and obviously Dublin, there's a lot of big improvements on last year as well as the year wore on. But I suppose, look, in terms of winning All-Ireland, we do probably look at Kilkenny and Galway. And for both of those, look, this year was probably disappointing in the sense of not fulfilling their full potential. Kilkenny, even though with their so five Leinsters, you'd always expect a little bit more. But look, it wouldn't have taken a whole pile for them to be in an All-Ireland final. They're probably victims of their own high standards. And so, I mean, they're 6 points up with 10, 11 minutes to go. And small margins, we could be talking about Kilkenny being All-Ireland champions here today, quite conceivably. And even with Galway, look, you'd have to argue that probably just it was a year that was disappointing for them. But, you know, there's loads of hurlers in Galway, and it wouldn't take a whole pile, a good league, and all of a sudden we could be talking about Galway. So I think, to be honest, with regard to Leinster, I think they're probably in a lot healthier position as a province as a whole than what they might have been in other generations.
And one last question before I let you go. As a Limerick man married to a Clare lady, do you have to endure some celebrations?
Defiance is already there, so I've been trying to defy the odds here for a long time. So, look, it's made to go around. She's had to endure a lot of the celebrations here in Limerick, and I suppose for her personally and her family, John Conlon will be a cousin of hers, and they take immense pride in what he has done. And look, every dog deserves a day, and I know there's nobody here in this county that would begrudge him. But I suppose, as we said there, look, it's we'll give it to him on loan for now. And please God, next year the bragging rights will return. But look, it's every dog has its day, and Clare most definitely deserved to have their day.
They most certainly did. Niall Moran from All the Game On team, thank you so much for your contribution since last February. I can't wait till we have you back on again.
Game On 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On, where we're going to switch our attention to the upcoming Olympic Games, which do kick off on Wednesday with the Rugby Sevens, but the opening ceremony, of course, is not until Friday, and Eoin O'Riordan, for the first time ever, it won't be in the stadium.
No, you're right, Ruby. They came up with this very bold and ambitious idea to float 180 boats, I think, a boat for every country down the River Seine in the heart of Paris, about a 6 kilometre route, starting just by Bercy and finishing more or less beside the Eiffel Tower at Trocadero. So it's certainly an ambitious idea that they've had. I mean, all sorts of security implications as well, but they're going to happen. It's going to happen anyway Friday evening. I think it's going to kick off about 6:30. Every country floats down, as we say, and then they all disembark, and that's where you have the kind of the flag ceremony on the streets of Paris. But I think that was very much the theme of these Olympics, is they're very much trying to bring it back into the heart of the city, like really make it use the city's iconic venues. And we all know Paris, whether it's things like the Eiffel Tower or the Plaza de Concorde and all these famous venues. That I think it's about 95% of the Olympic venues already existed. So they haven't gone building any white elephants or whatever they're known as these days. They're very much bringing these Olympics back into the city. The track and field are going to be up on the Stade de France. Some of the swimming events, the triathlon, will actually be in the River Seine, provided they get it cleaned up on time. But I think it's a great idea. I think if any city can pull that off, it is Paris, because I mean, we all know it's almost like a living museum to itself. It's so many iconic venues, but again, that does create a lot of difficulties for spectators just getting around and being able to just to get to the venues. But they're certainly ready. Every Olympics has doubts about certain will venues be done or not. So I think Paris have got everything ready on time now, and it's a bit like that old cliche: just let the games begin. I've been ticking off lists myself for the last few days, and I'm only going there to work. I think if you're an athlete or if you're competing, there's been a very sort of long, slow build up, and then it just suddenly gets just suddenly right on top of you. And it's the largest Olympic team we've ever had, 133 athletes, not including the reserves, in 15 different sports. That's up in about 15 from Tokyo 3 years ago. And I'm just looking at the list here in front of me. I don't ever remember more medal chances in such a different range of sports. I mean, I'm talking about 9 or 10 different sports: athletics, obviously, boxing, rowing, swimming. You mentioned the rugby sevens. Then you got gymnastics, and even you go all the way down to something like cycling. I think you could easily win 7 or 8 different medals in 7 or 8 different sports. We've only ever won medals in 6 sports, by the way: athletics, boxing, swimming, rowing, equestrian, and sailing. And to actually surpass that in one Olympics would be, well, pretty historic, obviously.
That's a big statement. So on you go there, back it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't, without even going into too much details, we've Reese McLenahan, a two-time world champion in gymnastics. We are probably the greatest lightweight rowing pair of all in Paula Donovan and Fintan McCarthy. We know we're going to win medals in boxing. We just know we've got 10 boxers, which is equal to the most amount of boxers we've ever qualified in the Olympics. I mean, Kelly Harrington going in there as a defending champion. I think we've got a great chance as well, and the likes of Grainne Walsh, Michaela Walsh, Aoife O'Rourke, 2 or 3-time European champion at this stage. Swimming, it's the first time we've had a swimming hope outside of Michelle Smith in Daniel Whiffen, a 2-time world champion in the men's freestyle 800 metres and 1500 metre freestyle. And anybody who's been following Daniel's progress over the last year will know that he's not shy about talking about his medal chances. He really believes he's going to win a medal, and I believe he will too. I'd be more disappointed if he doesn't win a medal. The men's rugby sevens have beaten every team. There's only 12 teams in that tournament. They've beaten them all: New Zealand, France, Fiji. They've got to go beat them again in a very small space of time. But again, I'd be very surprised if rugby don't put themselves in the mix. And then you look at track and field, my own sport that I've been following since I've been knee-high. And certainly, I don't ever remember having a genuine medal contender in a sprint event in Rashida Adeleke. I mean, what she's done over the last 2 or 3 years has been astonishing in the 400 metres. She's currently ranked 4th or 5th in the world, depending on who exactly shows up. And I keep saying that Rashida has the ability to win an Olympic medal. I just don't know if it's going to be in Paris. She's still only 21. It'll be her first Olympics. There's a huge expectation on her now. She certainly will be in the mix. Ironically, the mixed relay could be a real medal chance if Rashida puts herself up for that final, which is on early in the weekend. We saw they won the European Championships. They finished 3rd in the world relay. So to win a medal in the mixed relay, and I know it's a new event and it's kind of a novel event, but they all count. And I think for her to get a medal in the relay early on could take a lot of the pressure off as she goes into the individual 400 metres. We didn't even mention golf. Shane Lowry there, Rory McIlroy. We all know that they are capable of beating anybody on the day. And a few other outsiders too. I mean, sailing, we have Finn Lynch, who has won medals before in World Championships. The women's track cycling, and possibly show jumping as well. The men's show jumping team, they won the European Nations Cup there just a few weeks ago. They're one of the top teams in the world. So these are all my predictions. But look, the Olympics only come around once every 4 years for a reason. Like, the whole country, so the whole world is going in there with similar ambitions. And it's very difficult to predict Olympics because things will happen, things will go wrong. Reese McLennan, we saw him in Tokyo when he was one of the favourites, and it just took one little slip of the finger and his medal chance is gone. We've seen it as well in rowing, where you could be in a medal position that could all change in the last sort of 500 metres of that race. But we've won, I think the record medals we've won is 6 medals from London in 2012, including Katie Taylor, obviously, when she won the gold medal. I think we will surpass that. I think it's fair to say we're going to win 7 or 8 medals, including possibly 2 or 3 gold. And if anything, the question is, who's going to win at first? Who's going to win the first one?
I'm loving this positivity on a Monday evening. I think it's outstanding. Obviously, Rashida, if she is to run in the mixed relay final, that'll be on the 3rd of August. At least her own 400 metres doesn't start until the 5th, is it?
Yeah, she'll have 48 hours more or less to completely recover from the final, which is on the Saturday night, as you say, and then the heats are on the Monday night. More than 48 hours. But it just depends whether she wants to take that chance. And I think she will recover, but dare I say, if they win a medal, suddenly you got to go on the medal podium and you got all this, all the hype and the celebrations about winning a medal, and then you go back, you got to go back to the village and try and get some sleep. And you know, I know you might laugh at that, but that's the kind of stuff that you got to weigh up in terms of, do you want to put yourself at risk, and whether she wants to take that chance. I mean, there's no doubt if she does run the mixed relay that they're in a genuine medal winning position. I mean, it's going to be the same teams that they raced in the world relays, the USA obviously, and the Dutch team, who are really good. But outside of that, like, there's nobody else really that they have to beat to get on the medal podium. It's going to be tough. It's going to be very tough. And I do think the women's 400 metres, it's one of the most competitive events. And I was just watching the London Diamond League there on Saturday evening, and there's a young Jamaican now called Nikisha Price, who I hadn't really rated that highly. Of course, she comes out and runs the 7th fastest time in history, 48.7. So suddenly now she's, if anything, a gold medal favourite. So you just don't know in the Olympics who's going to come up and perform on the day. She's still got to get into the final, which is going to be, you know, the heats, semi-final, and get into the final. And then you've got 8 women all trying to get onto the podium. And then it depends on lane draws and all of that. But nothing that Rashida has done so far has surprised me. She keeps raising the bar on her own ability to perform. And we saw her winning in Monaco a couple of weeks ago, her first Diamond League win. She ran at 200 metres in London deliberately to just test her leg speed. And the critical thing for her is just to get out fast, to get out aggressive, and to make sure that she leaves nothing left in the legs, I suppose, for the first 200 metres, and then just to bring it on home. And if she can do that, she will definitely be in the mix for a medal.
Oh, it's so exciting. Obviously, the track and field doesn't start until Friday, the 2nd of August.
Yeah, so we have a full week of Olympics just to get through before that. But that's really where the swimming takes centre stage. And I mentioned Daniel Whiffen there, and he goes in the 800 metres first. And I think that's on next Tuesday or Wednesday. I think his final is on the Wednesday. I really believe that Daniel Whiffen will win a medal. I mean, there's two top guys he's got to beat. There's this Australian guy called Sam Short, and then Bobby Fink, who's defending champion in both the 800 metres and the 1500 metres freestyle. But Daniel Whiffen, he's just turned 23 last week, and he really believes that he can win a medal here. And again, I'd be more surprised if he doesn't win a medal than if he does. But you just don't know in the Olympics, and especially his events. Like, people forget 1500 metres is the longest event in the pool outside of the open water swim. It's almost like the marathon of the swimming events, and a lot can go wrong as well. There's always room for someone else to come through in the last couple of lengths or whatever it is, 32 lengths. But I'd be very excited for Daniel, and it'd be so nice to have a medal in the swimming pool for the first time since Michelle Smith in 1986, which unfortunately there's some clouds of doubt still hanging over.
Yeah, unfortunately there still is, but how's and ever, we move on from that one. For yourself, Ian, when are you going? Wednesday?
I head out tomorrow, Ruby. Yeah,
and tomorrow.
As I say, the bags are packed, and it's been a different sort of build up, because it's only been 3 years since Tokyo. Obviously, Tokyo being delayed for a year.
Yeah, but Tokyo also, because of COVID, it was marred a bit too. Do you think Paris is going to be a completely different games?
Absolutely, and I mean they're calling it a home Olympics, because I mean I'm looking at the list of names here in front of me, the 133 athletes. Every single one of them are going to bringing family members, mothers, grandmothers, aunts, uncles. I mean, there's going to be a huge Irish support base out there. We saw it during the Rugby World Cup, and they just seem to find tickets for these events. And I really wouldn't be surprised if, come the athletics finals, the swimming finals, the rugby sevens is already a sellout. There's going to be huge sections of these stands full of Irish supporters. And look, that brings its own pressure for sure, but it's going to be great for the athletes to have that, because that certainly wasn't in Tokyo 3 years ago, where you're running in an empty stadium. And that's not what the Olympics are about. And I think they've sold over 8 million tickets, which is a record for any Olympic venues to be sold like that. A lot of the events you can walk up and watch anyway, like the men's marathon, the women's marathon, just find your spot on the streets and you can watch that. But certainly that does bring its own pressures as well. I mean, in some ways it was a blessing for the athletes not to have too many family members in the crowd, but there'll be no doubting you will hear the Irish voices in Paris.
Paris also have set up huge fan zones all around the city, trying to include everybody, people who can't afford tickets or get tickets. It looks like the whole of Paris is going to be an Olympic venue.
Except maybe some of the locals. I think they're actually trying to get out of the city for the Olympics. A lot of the Parisians leave in late July, August anyway. But as I mentioned there, like, some of the iconic venues, and even like just looking at Jack Woolley here, who's competing in Taekwondo, great story. Like, I think this is actually his second Olympics now, but he gets to compete in the Grand Palais, which was built in the early 1920s as one of these iconic Parisian venues for one of the early expositions. And now they transform that into an Olympic venue. And they're the kind of places which you, just to be competing in the Olympics, but to competing in an iconic venue as well. The track and field is in the Stade de France, obviously, and they've completely renovated that stadium. They put down a purple running track. I'm not quite sure why that running track is purple, but it's a great venue for track and field. Like, the crowds are right close to the track, and that's one to look forward to as well. And the boxing events, some of the boxing events are being staged in an indoor arena, but all the finals are actually being staged in Roland Garros, the tennis tournament. So once you get into a medal bout, they bring you into the centre court in Roland Garros for your medal fight. So hopefully we'll see Kelly Harrington there. Will be the first woman to defend an Olympic gold medal if she does. I mentioned Paul O'Donovan as well. He's looking to defend his medal. And if he wins a third Olympic medal, he'd be the first Irish athlete in any sport to win a medal in three successive Olympics. So these are the sort of historical backdrops that we have to look forward to over the next 2 weeks. But without repeating myself, I really think that these are going to be the most successful Olympics that we've ever had before.
I hope you're right. The question, of course, is in Versailles. There is football in Marseille, Lille, Lyon, Nice and Nantes. It's spread all around. But what about the four new sports? Breaking, surfing, which is in Tahiti. You're not even going to get to Paris if you're into surfing. Sports climbing and skateboarding.
Yeah, I know. You put me on the spot there now. I mean, I think the breaking is happening. It's basically breakdancing. It's a trying to attract more younger generation people into the sport.
It's sold out.
Yeah. The rock climbing is a phenomenal sport. That's really grown, I think, worldwide. And again, it's a young sport. I mean, no disrespect to some of the maybe traditional equestrian events or modern pentathlon. They're not a young person's sport. So the Olympics that they're trying to do, surfing, we know that. I mean, they had surfing as a test event in Tokyo, and it was hugely successful. I'm not sure if I'm going to get down to Tahiti for some of the surfing events, but I think this is the way the Olympics, it has to move with the times, and I don't see any reason why they're not doing that. It's the last year, by the way, for the lightweight rowing. They're doing away with that completely, and they're bringing in an off-coast rowing event. So that they're always trying to maneuver different sports around. But I'm not sure. We don't have any Irish competitors in the breaking, but I think for some of the local younger generation, that, as you say, they're going to be the events not to be missed.
Alan, are you buying breaking and skateboarding?
No, I'm not having them, Ruby, to be honest with you. But yet, if you're there on America, good luck to them. I'm actually, Ian is after giving some rundown there in terms of, I suppose, the hype, and even myself coming across in the car, I was just thinking, I don't think we've ever had more realistic contenders, really, and medal contenders and medal hopes, so it's brilliant. And there's three or four as well. I think there's three from Sligo, Ruby, that I want to give a shout out to: Chris O'Donnell, Mona McSharry and Dean Clancy. One in the boxing, Chris obviously part of the athletics team, and Mona McSharry, who's a fantastic young swimmer, so that's where my eyes will be, and I hope they do themselves justice over there as well and do really well.
Well, I think it'll be incredible. I was watching athletes going into the Olympic Village on, I think it was Saturday, in Australian, Japanese, USA athletes. I'm assuming the rugby sevens are in Paris already, seeing as they're competing on Wednesday. What about the rest of the Irish squad?
Yeah, they come in dribs and drabs. As you say, like, the track and field aren't on until Friday week, so a lot of those are training just in a camp just outside of Paris. And as I say, the rugby sevens, and again, without going on about it, like, they have beaten everybody in the world over the last series sevens. And I mean, they will probably have to beat France, who are gold medal favourites, who have a certain Anton DuPont on board this year. That final is on the first Saturday. It's already a sellout. I mean, what a way to start off the Olympics would be, an Ireland-France final, and revenge for last year at the World Cup, I think would be on everyone's minds. But just one last point about this team. I mean, there's young athletes, there's lots of young athletes, but it's the most diverse team as well. I mean, I'm just looking at it here, some of the names. I mean, we've come a long way in the sport, where maybe some of the Olympic sport were a little bit more elitist, or we mightn't have had the range of sports from badminton to canoe slalom to cycling. And we've got our first women's track cycling team and the women's team pursuit, and We still don't have a velodrome in this country. I'm not quite sure how that happens, where you can qualify a team in the velodrome. So I think a lot of credit needs to go to Sport Ireland and the new Olympic Federation of Ireland as well, who've really changed the face of Irish Olympic sport now. And they've put the athlete first, and they've made sure that every athlete is getting the best possible support and preparations. And I think we're going to see that reflected in Paris over the next 2 weeks.
I think we will, Ian. I hope you enjoy it. We will be wall-to-wall Olympics here on Game On from Wednesday when the Rugby Sevens kicks off. But switching our attention to golf, Remy Burns joins us on the line after the British Open, or the Open, sorry, from Royal Troon at the weekend. Scotty Scheffler, he just kept his head, Remy, when everybody else couldn't.
Yes, absolutely, Ruby. How are you today?
Xander Schauffele, sorry, not Scotty Scheffler. He couldn't keep his head. I wish he could. He was the one I fancied. But Xander Schauffele did. How are you, Remy?
All good. Yeah, the Open was phenomenal, in my opinion. You know, the winner went and won it. Nobody really lost it. Maybe only Scheffler was the one on the last day that didn't. Sort of, the putter didn't shine. But Xander Schauffele, he really knew what he was doing. He won the PGA earlier on this year, and you know, he knew what he was at. He thought every part of his game was a real good asset: putting, chipping, iron play, driving the golf ball. And fortunately for him, he got the 9-under, and Rose played phenomenal golf, got the 7, and Billy Horsell played great golf, Shane played great golf. All the top 10, top 12 players just played phenomenal golf.
You really saw on Saturday afternoon guys digging in. Unfortunately, Saturday afternoon wasn't Shane's afternoon, but when you watched Billy Horschel, you watched Xander, Justin Rose, how they dug in on Saturday afternoon, it was incredible to watch them in the elements late on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it was certainly one of the worst sort of 2 hours that I've ever seen in my golfing career, players playing golf in. You know, it was, the wind just got so strong, and the driving rain, and the golf course became like two drivers to 15, a driver in 17. Like, you know, the 17th hole, I think Scotty Scheffler probably hit one of the greatest golf shots ever seen live TV. The 3-wood he hit in there, and then the driver 2-iron he hit up 18. And I mean, it was just one of those sort of 2 hours that was just incredible. And for Justin Rose and Billy Horsell to keep their nerves. And I mean, Xander was a wee bit earlier than them. He finished, I think he shot 300 par, but he's probably one of the, you know, the best golf scores seen on the golf course, maybe since Greg Norman and Turnberry, when he won in Turnberry in the howling wind and the gales. And as difficult as it was into the wind, it was also very, very difficult downwind to hold your ball on the fairways, hold your ball in the greens. But it was just one of those real, you know, you say cute, but you had to be cute and crafty, but you also had to golf your ball. And fortunately enough, you know, Rose and Horschel did that. And unfortunately, Shane got caught out in the postage stamp and caught him out with a 5. And then obviously you've seen what happened on 11. So, and he just fell away. And it's very hard to win a championship, you know, when you're leading after 2 rounds and then you have a bad score, suppose, on Saturday to come back and hold your head. But certainly Shane Lowry came back in. He played great golf yesterday. He had an opportunity to get, but then obviously Xander just went streaks ahead in the end and just played unbelievable golf down the stretch.
He most certainly did. Great to see Padraig Harrington make the cut and finish just outside the top 20. Fair play to him.
Yeah, Padraig Harrington, phenomenal. You know, the day before, played phenomenal golf. It was great to see him. That sets him in good stead now for going to Carnoustie this week now for the seniors, and we expect to see, hopefully he'll be able to pop that trophy that he was beating the playoff last year by Alexander Cheka. So let's hope that he can do that, you know.
A bit of luck he can. Remy, I would love to talk for much longer, but unfortunately we are out of time. My apologies to Xander Schauffele, although I doubt very much that he is listening. I'll be back tomorrow evening. Thanks to Alan and Ian for coming into the studio, for Ronan Lawler for producing. January Winters is up next.